Welcome to Season 3 of Felon, True Crime Podcast. If you've stuck around after what was a much longer than expected break, welcome back, and thanks a lot for your patience. If you're a first-time listener, welcome aboard, and I'm eager to hear what you think of the podcast, and hopefully you'll have the chance to listen through the back catalogue of previous episodes. For those of you that follow Felon on social media, you'd be aware of a number of personal events that have caused me to put the podcast on hold, one of which was a major one. On the 28th of February of 2018, we welcomed our second son into the world. And so needless to say, things have been pretty hectic in the Felon household during the lead up to and especially following his birth. But as things start to settle, I'm planning to keep releases to the fortnightly or bi-weekly schedule. Before we kick off season 3, I'm hoping that you can all do me a favour. If you've been following online, you would have noticed that I've submitted Felon to be considered in the 2018 Australian Podcast Awards. There are two categories. One is the documentary category, which is self-nominated and will come down to the decision of a panel of judges. But there is also a popular vote category. This is where I need the help of everyone who is listening right now. To vote for Felon, all you need to do is go online and head over to AustralianPodcastAwards.com or simply search for Australian Podcast Awards, and then when you get there, click on the vote link, which is on the top right-hand side of the page. There is a really brief registration required, but then all you need to do is scroll through the thumbnails of the various podcasts until you see the Felon logo. Click on that logo, and when it takes you to the voting page, all you need to do is click on the thumbs up icon. As soon as that icon turns blue, you will know that your vote has been accepted. If you get stuck at all, the instructions for voting are listed on the webpage. To make it even easier, I'll also put a link to the voting page in the episode notes, but you can also find it on the Felon Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Voting for podcasts will remain open to the public until the 1st of April, so I'd really appreciate it if you could take a few moments to send a vote my way. Every vote counts. While you're there, you can also send some love in the form of votes to fellow Aussie true crime podcasters, Insight, Bloody Murder, and True Crime Island. Before we begin, a big thank you goes out to a good friend of mine, Doug Smith, and also Minna, host of True Crime Finland, who were both kind enough to lend me their voices for this episode. Here's a soundbite from True Crime Finland. I hope you enjoy Minna's podcast as much as I have. A link to True Crime Finland will also be included in the episode notes.
Hi, this is Minna from True Crime Finland. Finland, so peaceful and safe. There isn't even any crime there, right? Wrong. Join me every 2 weeks in discovering the dark side of the land of a thousand lakes. Everything from human trafficking and Ponzi schemes to double homicide and child abuse. From the forgotten and lesser known to the legendary and infamous Finnish cases, the podcast will be sure to offer something for everyone. You can find True Crime Finland on iTunes, Pocket Casts, Podcast Addict, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Gain entry without destroying the property.
Received, thank you, Steve. Gain entry.
Yeah, handle now.
Received, 13.05.
Romeo Echo
410,
did
you copy that? 412
with
no name entry.
Romeo Echo
412. 412, go.
1.
Yeah, 412, sorry, go again.
We have a 501.
Ann Redman and Perjo Kimpainen lived over 60 kilometres from each other. Their paths had never crossed. Anne lived in the seaside South Australian suburb of Seacliff. Perjo lived in the small town of Callington in the eastern slopes of the Adelaide Hills. Despite being complete strangers to each other, their names would soon be spoken regularly in the same breath for years to come. Part 1. Anne Redman. She checks that her doors and windows are locked, turns out her lights, and eases herself into bed. It is a place she has called home for 50 years. It is familiar. It is comfortable. She knows the sounds of it well, the creaks, the rattles, and the groans. Even now, living alone in the home, she has felt safe within its walls, and now within its warm embrace, she drifts off to sleep. The sudden sound of an unfamiliar noise shakes her from her peaceful slumber. Is it her imagination? Maybe a dream? With bleary eyes, she pulls herself up and out of bed, makes her way across the darkness of her room to the nearest light switch, and flicks it on. But there is no light. She tries another. Still, no light. Retrieving a torch, she makes her way towards the rear of the house, and then out into the backyard, into the darkness, her small torch providing a faint circle of light at her feet. She shuffles forward, cautiously edging her way towards the electrical box, intent on discovering the cause of the disruption to her power supply. But in the darkness, she is not alone. 87-year-old Anne Redman lived alone in her Yacca Road home in the seaside suburb of Adelaide called Seacliff. Anne had called this place home since 1952, when her and her husband Philip purchased it soon after arriving in Adelaide from England as immigrants, referred to as 10-pound Poms. In her younger years, Anne was known for her stunning looks and for a period of time worked as a model in England. She also went on to serve in the Women's Royal Auxiliary Air Force. While in England, she met her husband Philip, and the two soon decided to make the move to Australia for a new life together. The couple enjoyed their time in the Seacliff home for half a century, and within its walls, many fond memories were formed. A highlight for both was the birth of their daughters. Sadly, in 2005, Anne was left a widow when her husband Philip died, but she made the abrupt transition into a solitary life the best she could, with her loyal terrier Spotty to keep her company. She also had the support of family members who lived nearby. Two of her sisters and one of her daughters lived only minutes from her home, and despite her advanced years and arthritis, she remained socially active with a wide circle of friends. On Wednesday, the 26th of January, 2011, Chris Miller made his way to the home of his mother-in-law, Anne Redman. His wife, Susan Redman, who had recently become concerned about her mother, had called him there. Susan had last spoken to Anne around 5 p.m. on Tuesday, the 25th of January. It was a casual chat, just to check in, and the pair had discussed meeting up sometime over the following days, so it was only a brief call. The next day, between midday and 2 p.m, Susan tried calling her mother twice. Both times, there was no answer. Susan just chalked this up to her mother not wearing her hearing aids and simply missing the calls, and opted to drop by her mother's home instead. At 5:40 p.m. that same day, Susan arrived at Anne's home to a disturbing discovery. As she approached, she could see that the front door was wide open. This didn't sit right with her from the get-go, as she knew her mother to be very security conscious. She attempted to contact her mother's neighbours, and when she couldn't get hold of any of them, she called her husband Chris, who quickly made his way over to his concerned wife. Susan was now waiting out the front of her mother's home. While Chris entered, he cautiously moved through all the rooms, then on to the backyard. Although she was already concerned for her mother's well-being, Susan would not be prepared for the news that Chris would deliver. He emerged slowly from the front door, and with a now pale face, almost buckling at the knees, spoke the words, "Your mother has been murdered. She is dead." Chris had made a gruesome discovery. He had located Anne's body in the backyard. She lay on the ground, bruised and battered. Blood pooled around her from a large wound to her neck. The authorities were quickly alerted, and investigators made their way to the scene. A closer analysis of Anne's wounds revealed that the attack had been excessively brutal. She had received multiple fractures to her nose and vertebrae, 7 stab wounds to her neck, and a range of defensive wounds to her hands and arm. There was also evidence of blunt force trauma to her face, neck, and arms. A search of the property revealed that the main power supply to the house had been turned off at the meter box. A screen to a toilet window had been cut, and a number of glass louvers of the same window had been removed, one of which had been broken. At a first glance, it seemed to be a burglary gone wrong that had then escalated to a violent attack, and it was speculated that it was likely that the offender would have been under the influence of drugs to carry out such a savage attack upon someone so vulnerable. Anne was dressed in her nightgown, indicating that the attack had occurred sometime during the night or in the early hours of the morning. Inside the home, forensic officers discovered traces of blood believed to belong to Anne, and it was determined that the attacker had fled through the home rather than jumping a fence. There was no evidence that indicated that the attacker spent any time inside the home, and there were no fingerprints left behind. In carrying out a search of the surrounding areas, detectives discovered that three more houses that were unoccupied also had their power turned off at the mains, indicating that the attacker had tried a number of homes prior to settling on Anne's. Residents of Seacliff and the adjoining suburbs were instantly put on edge, and fear of another attack spread throughout the community. So great was the fear that elderly residents were reluctant to leave their homes and made sure that their doors and windows were all securely locked. Apart from the signs of forced entry, the fact that the power of other homes had been tampered with, and blood throughout the home, detectives weren't left with much evidence to go on. On the 17th of February, almost a month had passed, and police were still not any closer to finding Anne Redmond's killer. Her devastated daughters made a heartfelt plea to the public for their assistance in finding the person responsible. One of her daughters, Karen Batsiokas, made the following public statement. "We all knew Mum was 87 years old, but Mum was healthy. She still caught the bus to go shopping. She still did her crosswords. She read, and she was a lot of fun. My mother was a lovely woman who enjoyed her life, and I believe she had many more years left to enjoy. As a community, we need to find this person who is responsible. It has had a devastating effect on our whole family. Not only has my sister and I lost our mother, but she had two surviving sisters who were into their 90s, and both of them are still very active. We're all shocked and saddened by what has happened, and the fact remains that the person who is responsible is still out there, and I think they need to be brought to justice, both for my peace of mind and for the safety of the community. Please help if you have any information, if you have anything at all, even if it seems insignificant. Please help the police solve the crime." By the end of March, 2 months after Anne's death, detectives made the announcement to the public that they were closely scrutinizing 60 persons of interest. These were mainly individuals who were known to have a history of housebreaking. But despite this large number of persons of interest, detectives soon conceded that none of these people had emerged as a key suspect. A Crime Stopper hotline had been set up, and by this stage, they had received 65 calls from people with possible leads. Detective Superintendent Moyle said that he and his team were heartened by this and urged the public to get in touch if they felt they could help in any way. He stated, "It is not unusual for people to discuss these types of things with close friends and associates. There may be some misguided loyalty for people to perhaps protect an offender they think has just broken into a house. But this goes far beyond that. I don't think it would be unusual for the person who has committed the crime to discuss it with other close friends, family, or associates. This was not an accidental death. It was quite a deliberate action. I would appeal to those individuals, if they are aware of who is responsible for this, to contact police." 8 months passed, and still it seemed that Anne Redmond's killer would escape justice. But as predicted by Detective Superintendent Moyle in his media statement, it seemed that someone had indeed started to talk to close friends. These conversations had been referred to police, and while the public and media were unaware, investigators had made significant progress in building a case against an alleged offender, or, as they came to discover, two alleged offenders. These two individuals were not among the original 60 persons of interest police had been questioning, and they did not have a history of violence or a criminal background. The two new persons of interest were teenagers. Due to both of them being minors at the time of the murder, the pair, for legal reasons, cannot be named, but for the sake of the story, they'll be referred to as Brad and James. Brad and James had come to the attention of police based on a number of tips from witnesses, mainly friends who had either heard directly from each of them or who had heard rumors along the grapevine. At the time of Anne Redmond's death, Brad was just 16 years old. He had a stable home life and was reported to have had a close relationship with his father, who was a police officer, and his mother, who was a nurse. Brad was involved in a range of activities outside of working as a chef, and was socially active with his group of peers, by whom, it was reported, he was well-liked. His friend James was 17 at the time. He was born in Sydney and moved to South Australia with his family when he was 11 years old. He also came from a stable and supportive family. At the age of 11, he was diagnosed with dyslexia and struggled at school. This was a guiding factor when choosing to finish high school early, commencing an apprenticeship. With the disengagement from school and the frustration created by boredom, James began to slip into antisocial behavior. The two boys had occasionally used recreational drugs like cocaine and cannabis, but apart from a couple of traffic infringements, they did not have a criminal record or any dealings with authorities. Brad and James had met each other at Marden Senior College and struck up a friendship while they were students there. James left partway through year 11 to commence an apprenticeship to become a chef, and Brad, after completing year 11, also left school and followed in James's footsteps, also starting a chef apprenticeship. Both boys had not enjoyed their time at school, and so making the change to the workforce gave them direction and income and some independence. Unfortunately for Brad, it would not be long before he would lose his job, and with it, the income and the independence that he had come to enjoy. With the loss of employment, Brad began to explore ways to make some quick money. Time would soon tell that the pair were not a good influence on each other, and the solution they arrived at together was robbing houses to make a quick buck. It was this choice that would soon lead them to the home of Ann Redmond on the night of January the 25th. As all kids do, they told stories about their exploits, and soon rumors had started to spread among their peers relating to the death of Ann Redmond. It was a case that had received a lot of media coverage. With the information that friends had heard from Brad and James, combined with the gruesome details being shared on the news, it was only a matter of time before someone would talk to authorities. As information trickled through, police started to build their case against Brad and James. A mutual friend of the boys reported receiving a hunting knife from Brad as a gift, and upon handing it over to him, he had said, "You might want to clean it. I did something bad with it. Someone died by that knife." The same individual, who also cannot be named, but is referred to as AW, recounted receiving a phone call from Brad, who had told him to dispose of the knife in the ocean. At this point, police were closing in on the boys, and it was a visit from authorities that had prompted Brad to make the call. Police were also focusing on James, and in a call that they had intercepted during a conversation with a friend from interstate, he was heard to mention that the knife was long gone. On the 21st of September, 2011, police swooped on James's family home to conduct a search of the premises. In James's room, they found the evidence that they needed. It was a backpack, and inside this backpack were two blood-stained balaclavas. Forensic testing indicated it was Anne's blood. A follow-up search of Brad's car yielded further evidence, uncovering a battery-powered torch that had belonged to Anne. To add to this, AW, the friend who had disposed of the knife, was now assisting police with locating the murder weapon. Under his direction, they searched the water at O'Sullivan Beach, and they were able to locate the knife. The evidence against the two boys was undeniable. When confronted with it, they buckled, and both made confessions, admitting their guilt. With these confessions came the shocking details of Ann Redmond's terrifying last moments. In the early hours of the 26th of January, 2011, Brad and James had broken into another home, which they discovered to be unoccupied. Finding no items of value inside, they fixed their gaze on the home of Ann Redmond. The lights were out, and there was no car in the driveway. They put on gloves and balaclavas and made their way to the backyard of the property. Carefully, they removed the glass louvers of the toilet window. James cut the fly screen and attempted to enter the property. In doing so, a glass louver slipped and broke, causing him to hurry through the window, and in this haste, he stepped on the flush mechanism of the toilet, causing the toilet to flush. The sound of breaking glass and running water caused Anne to wake. In attempting to turn on a light, she realized that the main power supply had been interrupted, presumably by a trip meter. She quickly dressed in a nightgown, grabbed a torch, and made her way to the backyard to check the power meter, unaware that James was now inside the house. As Anne turned the corner in the backyard, she was confronted by a blood-curdling sight. In the faint glow of her tiny torch, crouched a masked figure staring back at her. Realizing that he had now been seen, Brad lunged at Anne, knocked her to the ground, and pinned her down. With his weight bearing down on her frail body, she tried to break free. James, who was still inside the home, heard the struggle and ran to see Brad holding Anne down. James ran back through the house and out the front door to Brad's car that was parked in the street. From the car, he collected an object and made his way back to where Brad was still holding down the terrified widow. James, who was also wearing a balaclava, emerged from the darkness holding a long hunting knife, and he made his way over to Brad and Anne. Although there are discrepancies between the two accounts of the boys as to what happened next, with each trying to diminish their involvement. Anne would be beaten to the face and neck. She would receive several defensive cuts to her arms, and finally 7 stab wounds to the throat. These wounds would be fatal. The defensive wounds indicated that Anne had fought bravely until the end, but she was elderly and weakened by arthritis. She would have been no match for 2 strapping young teenagers armed with a hunting knife. With the evidence stacked against them, and both making a confession admitting to their guilt, their trial would be a short one. But even though Anne Redmond's attackers were finally brought to justice, Anne's family, friends, neighbours and community were left with the question, what would drive 2 young men with no prior convictions or history of violence to carry out such a brutal and senseless act against one so vulnerable? A forensic psychologist attached to the case gave the opinion that the murder was motivated by anxiety, panic, immaturity, criminal incompetence, and negative peer pressure. While both tried to minimize their involvement in the crime, the judge was left with no choice but to find them both equally responsible for Anne Redmond's death. They were each sentenced to life imprisonment with a non-parole period of 20 years. A disturbing detail was noted by a chief investigator on the case, John Keane. Keane was pivotal in bringing the boys to justice after he had pursued a tip-off that one of them was boasting about the crime. In following this lead, he discovered that at least 12 of their friends had known about the crime, but they hadn't reported it to police.
Relief for Anne Redmond's family.
Well, I think they're where they belong, in jail. I think it was a strong message. 20 years is a long time.
Despite hearing horrific details of her mother's brutal death, Ms. Redmond's daughter still had sympathy for the convicted teens.
The fact that those boys spend their youth in a jail, it doesn't bring me any happiness or closure. I feel sad for them too.
After the hearing, one of the killer's families lashed out, while the other boy's father, a long-serving police officer, walked silently from court.
The families of the boys are victims as well. No one expects their children to do such a thing.
On the night of the murder, the boys had been breaking into several homes in the southern suburbs until they were caught by Miss Redmond in her Seacliff backyard. Justice Nyland said, "I'm perplexed why the two of you chose to react in killing Miss Redmond in such a gruesome way instead of just running away."
They were acting as predators. They were having this... They were acting as if they were in a TV movie, you know, let's gear up, let's get into this house.
Although only one boy dealt the fatal blow, the judge found you were both equally responsible for the senseless and horrific crime. The cold-blooded murder shocked the elderly community, who can now rest easier.
The elderly were scared, and I don't think they should be prisoners in their own home. They deserve to be able to, you know, live in their house and enjoy their last days.
Ms. Redmond's family also thanked one particular witness for coming forward, and police this afternoon revealed just how vital their information was. They issued a statement revealing that it was that person's moral courage that led to today's successful outcome. Now, the boys are both 18, but they will spend another year in juvenile detention before being transferred to an adult prison, where the judge says they will receive special protection because of their age and the notoriety of the case.
Part 2. Pöyö Kempainen. From a young age, I've had psychopathic thoughts. From 3rd grade, all I've wanted to do was abduct someone and torture them and have a little fun. Don't ever think you can befriend me, because I'll cut you so gently, I will turn your bedroom into a blood frenzy. Don't think I can ever change. Unfortunately, the murder of Anne Redmond was not the first of its kind in South Australia. In 2010, the small country town of Callington was devastated by a savage attack that was also committed against an elderly woman who lived alone. In the early hours of the 11th of September, 2010, at 12:34 a.m, a phone call was made to the police assistance line in Adelaide. The following is a recreation of part of that call.
Hello? South Australia Police, how can I help you?
I'm calling from Kellington. I've got a bricked house. There is some, I think, a couple of teenagers have come to break my window, my sliding door window.
They broke your window?
Yeah.
How long ago?
5 minutes ago.
Do you know where they are now?
I don't know. They ran away. They were earlier here in the night. They were here and they said they were looking for a dog. Two boys. They did come back while I was asleep.
Did you see them throw the rock and break your window?
I didn't see them, but they were knocking my door first, and after that they threw the rock into the window.
This call was made by a Poyo Kempainen. Poyo was a 63-year-old retired nurse who had immigrated with her family to Australia from Finland in 1968. She had called Kellington home for over a decade, and during this time, she had lived alone. Poyo enjoyed a quiet life and was well liked by those who knew her. She spent her days gardening and painting and was described as a gentle lady who was small in stature but big in spirit. Kellington is a quiet farming town on the eastern slopes of the Adelaide Hills, approximately 45 minutes drive from the Adelaide CBD. Poyo lived in a three-bedroom weatherboard home on the eastern side of town, approximately 400 meters from the Central General Store. On the eastern side of her home was Bremer River, and on the western side was an old sandstone church building. 3 weeks prior to making the call to police, Poyo's father had passed away, and with the assistance of her brother, Veli-Pekka Kempainen, her family was in the process of dividing some of her father's possessions. Her brother, Veli-Pekka, picked up some of his father's furniture and made his way to Poyo's home to deliver it to her. Upon entering her home, he found Poyo lying on the floor in her laundry in a pool of blood. It was obvious from the visible injuries that this was not an accident. A sliding glass door had been broken and there were scattered pieces of concrete blocks. In a panic, Veli-Pekka contacted police, and Poyo's home was declared a crime scene.
Police have assured a small Adelaide Hills community they'll do everything they can to solve the death of a local woman. The 63-year-old was discovered in her Kellington home.
Police spent much of the morning combing for evidence at the Murray Street transportable home. A smashed window and a set of steps attracting interest. A police sniffer dog also searching for clues.
Quite distressed, actually. Yeah, I'm sort of still quite shocked by it all.
The woman lived alone. Her brother raised the alarm at 5 p.m. yesterday after he went to the house to drop off some furniture.
We'll be doing everything we can to find out what happened and by who as soon as we can.
From what I do know of her and the conversations and time I've spent with her, she's not the sort of person who would invite trouble.
Neighbours say the woman had lived in the town for about a decade and seldom had visitors.
Just a very quiet lady that pretty much stayed to herself and potted in her garden. That was about the only time you really seen her, was when she was out in the garden.
You know, but anybody says she'd always wave to you and speak to you. She was a lovely lady. She wouldn't hurt a fly.
Police wouldn't comment on whether they believe the woman is the victim of a random attack, but say the police presence in Kellington will be stepped up over the coming week.
At this stage, it's very early on in the investigation. What I'm really concerned about is the people of Kellington being frightened.
Any witnesses are being asked to come forward.
Poyo's injuries were extensive. According to forensic reports, she received at least 58 stab wounds and was struck to the head up to 70 times with a chunk of concrete. The blows were so savage that they left deep gouge marks in her skull. As the news of this vicious attack spread throughout the tight-knit community, the town found itself in the grip of fear that a killer was still on the loose. South Australia Police geared up for a homicide investigation, but they would soon find themselves under scrutiny from media and the community of Kellington.
Police admit they may have made a fatal mistake in ignoring a call made by a murder victim just hours before her death. The 63-year-old reported her window had been smashed, but no patrol was sent.
Call records indicated that Poyo had in fact made a call to emergency services. The emergency services phone line, who was manned by a public servant, failed to refer Poyo's call for help to police, so a patrol car was not sent to check on her. This would prove to be a deep embarrassment to South Australia Police, and more seriously, it would be considered a contributing factor in the tragic fate of Poyo.
We did receive a call. The call related to the breaking of a window with some sort of stone.
Police admitted at the time that a major error in judgment was made by the public servant who took Poyo's call, failing to send a patrol car to her house. The call taker had submitted an incident report, but did not pass the call onto the communications centre to dispatch any patrol.
The police commissioner says Ms. Kampainen's thick Finnish accent may have contributed to the confusion, but that will be investigated as part of a review into what went wrong.
Despite a scathing reaction from the media and the community alike, South Australian detectives and forensic investigators worked through to collect any possible pieces of the puzzle that could lead them to Perjo's killer. An initial search of the home revealed two distinct sets of footprints and fingerprints. In an area of bush along a creek opposite Perjo's home, they discovered two buckets, one of which contained a rubber glove, some discarded clothes, and some cleaning products. As police canvassed the area, talking with neighbours and locals in surrounding areas, they also soon discovered that two teenage boys had been seen in the area. When combined with the information that Perjo had provided in her phone call about the two young boys, this led police to believe that these sightings could be significant. But so brutal was the attack on Perjo that it was hard for the authorities to believe it could be the work of children. An appeal was made for the boys to make contact with police, with the hope they could potentially be key witnesses. Perjo led a quiet life, and as far as detectives could tell, there was no one in Callington that harboured any ill feelings towards her. Without any other leads, the sightings of the boys, Perjo's phone call, and the forensic evidence discovered at the scene was the best that detectives had to go on. But it wouldn't be long before this information would soon lead police to two persons of interest. In the wake of Perjo's death, fear and speculation spread throughout the small community. Many had theories, but it was the intimate knowledge of the event that was shared by a teenager amongst his peers that caught the attention of investigating officers. Word came back to detectives that a 14-year-old boy had been telling his friends that the lady who everyone was talking about had been bashed with a rock, and police were unsure if she bled to death or had died from being stabbed. This was classified information, and at the time the youth shared it with his friends, it had not been made public. Police moved in and commenced the search of his family home. During this search, they located a t-shirt. The t-shirt had staining that appeared to be blood. Initial testing confirmed it was female blood, and a follow-up analysis revealed that it belonged to Perjo. CCTV footage obtained by police also showed the youth wearing the same shirt on a prior occasion, confirming that it did in fact belong to him. With this evidence, investigators had enough to take the boy into custody. But this individual was not the only one who had been seen in the CCTV footage, and police soon made their way to a second arrest. Another 14-year-old boy. The young men in question were inseparable schoolmates. They were both in the 8th grade. Due to the age of the boys at the time, they are unable to be named, but they will be referred to as Trent and Alex. Both boys were considered to be social outcasts. The pair had forged a bond that revolved around late-night movies, video games, underage drinking, and roaming the streets of Callington. They also spoke often of reenacting the behaviour of their favourite video game characters, who are featured in games like Gears of War, Saints Row, Hitman, and Grand Theft Auto. One of the boys in particular had a fascination with the violence contained in these games. At the age of 3, Trent's parents separated under less than friendly terms. Their hostility towards each other often exposed him to domestic violence from a very young age. Trent also had an extremely low IQ. As he grew older, he became socially isolated. This isolation led him to seek solace in a fantasy world, a world of violent movies and video games. At the age of 7, a psychologist noted that he had become fixated on ultraviolence and retribution, themes that were prominent in his favourite movie at the time, Scarface. This fantasy world soon found itself creeping into reality when he started to dress like criminals featured in violent games like Hitman and Saints Row. When asked by a psychologist as to what his wishes were, he was recorded to have said, "My wishes are killing more and more and more people. I wish I had a catapult that would hit someone in the head, and then they would all be dead." At the impressionable age of 10, Trent's use of his computer shifted from video games to internet pornography. At the age of 12, he received an Xbox 360. The Xbox became his playground. His playmates were hyper-realistic and violent game characters. And again, his online world began to spill into reality when by the end of grade 7, he began to speak to his classmates of fulfilling his fantasy of killing someone. On one occasion, in a fit of rage, Trent threatened to kill all of his classmates. His school principal, disturbed by the threat, but not enough to take him seriously, took him for some time out in the focus room. Due to Trent's ongoing academic struggles, he was allocated a teacher's aide to assist him while in class. On one occasion, during a cooking class, in what seemed to be an attempt to impress her, Trent spun a knife on his thumb and offered to murder her old man for $10. Potentially a response to being the target of bullying, it was also around this time that he began to carry a knife with him wherever he went around town. Prior to the attack on Peryo, due to his violent fantasies and temper, Trent had come to the attention of his teachers on many occasions. In May of 2010, he told a staff member at his high school that he wanted to be a gangster and a rapper, and he wanted to kill people for money. On a school excursion on the 9th of September 2010, 2 days prior to Peryo's violent death, he confided in a teacher that he wanted to stab someone. These threats, while shocking, seemed more like a cry for attention, and due to not being taken seriously, were not acted upon with the concern they deserved. On the 10th of September, the day leading up to Peryo's death, in response to being suspended for punching another student in the head, Trent uttered the words to the teacher who was suspending him, "If you do this, someone will die." But again, his threat was not taken seriously. That evening, he met with his best friend Alex on the main street of Callington and spoke the words that would soon seal Peryo's fate. "Tonight's the night. We're going to kill someone tonight." Typically, a conversation of this nature among peers would spark concern, but Alex was well aware of Trent's violent mind. The pair lived on the same street and had quickly become friends. Socially isolated from their peers, the pair would spend entire weekends together on sleepovers. They both loved movies and video games and would often be found by their parents, crashed out in front of the screen. Although Alex didn't dwell on murderous thoughts like Trent, he would soon play his part in Peryo's demise. It was alleged that it was Alex that nominated Peryo as their victim because she lived alone. When questioned over his actions, Trent expressed that at the time he was the target of taunting and bullying. The frustration of this, coupled with his already violent tendencies, became an internal volcano of rage that seemed would inevitably erupt. Despite all the warning signs leading up to this point, he had slipped through the system, and unfortunately, there was no one who could sway him from the course that he had now set his mind upon. As the night drifted into the early hours of the 11th of September, the two boys approached Peryo's home and stood across the road from it. The lights were out, and they knew that she lived alone. They slowly made their way across the road and approached her door. In a statement provided by Trent, he detailed his recollection of the evening. They'd spent the early part of the night at Trent's home, hanging out and enjoying their favourite pastime, watching movies and playing games. Trent's father was home, but by around 11 p.m, he retired to bed, leaving the two boys to their own devices. Trent and Alex, now unsupervised, turned from their movies and video games to something more sinister, and they began using a discarded mattress to practice their stabbing techniques with knives they had now armed themselves with. The two then stole beer from a neighbor's shed, drank them, then made their way out into the streets of Callington. As they walked, the two casually discussed which of them should stab their victim first. Trent suggested to Alex that he would stab her first, and then Alex could follow. This conversation continued until they arrived at the unsuspecting Peryo's door. They knocked, and after some time, Peryo appeared in the doorway with a torch in her hand, shining it in their faces as they stood in the darkness of her veranda. With their bravado now wavering, they fabricated a story of looking for a missing dog, and they quickly fled back to Trent's home. But after a few more drinks, they again left towards Peryo's home. Again, both were armed with knives. Around midnight, the boys walked to the same door that they had approached previously. Trent picked up a lump of limestone and threw it towards Peryo's home, which shattered a hole in her rear sliding glass door. Upon throwing the stone, he sprinted a short distance to the grounds of a nearby church. Alex had stayed behind when Trent ran, and Peryo, shocked by the broken door, emerged to confront him on the footpath with the threat that she was going to call the police. It was after her confrontation with Alex that she made her call to emergency services, requesting the assistance of police. Peryo had recognized Alex from their interaction earlier in the night, when they had knocked on her door and inquired about a missing dog. In her call, she mentioned this to the operator, but in what would become the subject of an internal inquiry, help was not sent. This lack of police response was also noticed by the boys, who while Peryo had made her call and waited for assistance, were both hiding in the shadows of the riverbank, opposite her home, again deciding who would be the first to attack. When it was decided, the attack on Peryo would unfold in a violent frenzy. Again, based on information provided by Trent, Trent made his way to her back door again with a cold determination. He could see Peryo inside, still awake, possibly waiting for police to arrive. She saw him approaching the sliding door and came out through a nearby wooden door and demanded an explanation as to why he had thrown the rock through her sliding glass door. In Trent's own words, "I walked up to the house alone, walked up to the sliding door, and she came out through a wooden door. She asked why I had thrown the rock. I said I was drunk, and I put the knife in her stomach. I tried to stab her in the stomach, and then I repeatedly stabbed her in the head. She tried to hold her arms up to keep me from stabbing her. She was screaming. I have no idea how many times I stabbed her. I went outside to get a rock. She was about to shut the door on me, so I threw the rock at her door. It was a big chunk of rock, about 30 centimeters across. I ran through the door and continued to stab her until she was on the floor, making no sound. It was at this point that Trent retrieved a second piece of concrete and struck Puyo 69 times. Then, as a final act of violence, Trent concluded his account. The last thing I did was throw the slab of concrete at her head. When asked how he felt after the murder, he replied, "Relaxed." Trent then returned to where Alex was standing on the path and said, "I've done it. I've killed her." Upon hearing this news and seeing the blood on Trent's hands and clothing, Alex became distressed. But despite this distressed state, the pair returned to Perio's home and they rifled through her purse, cupboards and drawers. When they were finished, they made an attempt to clean up. Then they dumped buckets of cleaning products in the river and returned to Trent's home, where he cleaned himself, washed his clothes, drank beer, and fell asleep watching movies. It would only be a matter of days before that same home would become the focus of a police investigation and the two boys would be in custody. Following their capture, both boys turned on each other. Trent believed that he had covered their tracks well, and it must have been Alex that had spoken of their involvement, which led to their arrest. Trent swore that he would get revenge on his once inseparable companion. Alex's defense team attempted to diminish his involvement, claiming that he was just out to cause some mischief and had not been party to Trent's murderous intentions. Trent, upon hearing word of this, was coaxed by his defense team to testify against Alex. Despite Alex claiming that he had been coaxed to take part with threats from Trent, it was revealed by a friend of Alex, who he had spoken to about the murder, that when Alex had shared the information, he didn't appear to be distressed, but rather, he seemed happy. At no point did Trent deny his involvement, and when he went to trial, he pled guilty, agreeing to a deal in exchange for testifying against Alex. He was sentenced to a non-parole period of 15 years, and he will be eligible to be considered for release when he is 29. In May of 2015, Trent was transferred to an adult prison where he will serve the remainder of his sentence. On Thursday, the 11th of July, 2013, after 90 minutes of deliberation, a Supreme Court jury of 7 men and 4 women found Alex, who is now 17 years old, not guilty of the murder of Puyo Kampainen. The subject of rehabilitation is often discussed when referring to cases involving youth offenders. In the case of Trent, initial discussions with him whilst in custody indicated that this could be a long process. When hearing of the murder of Anne Redman in the seaside suburb of Adelaide, he became excited and bragged, "I've started a revolution. I'm a revolutionary. I just hope they don't catch this guy." While in a detention centre, it was also noted that he had spoken to staff members about mowing down motherfuckers with firearms. And, in a revealing insight into his state of mind leading up to and following the murder, as part of a detention center writing task, he penned the following rap lyrics. "From a young age, I've had psychopathic thoughts. From third grade, all I wanted to do was abduct someone and torture them and have a little fun. Don't ever think you can befriend me because I will cut you so gently. I will turn your bedroom into a blood frenzy. Don't think I can ever change." While we're left with little answers from Trent himself, the sentencing judge, Justice Nyland, said 4 factors were identified by the mental health experts as contributing factors to the murder. 1. The boy's low level of cognitive functioning put him in the range of mild mental retardation. This made it difficult for him to perform academically and impaired his ability to socialize. It made him unable to evaluate the consequences of his actions and what he wanted to do. 2. His exposure to domestic violence at an early age led to aggressive and disobedient behaviors. 3. He was subjected to bullying at school and was ostracized by his peers, which contributed to him becoming somewhat of a social outcast. He developed significant anger and hatred towards people and low empathy for others. And 4. The boy's continued exposure to violent video games and movies decreased his emotional empathy. The boy's recollection of his offending was described as a distant perspective, similar to that of an observer. The psychologist said the boy's lack of empathy towards his victim and lack of revulsion about the blood at the scene were because he had become desensitized by blood and gore he experienced in violent video games and movies. As for Alex's role in the murder, even though he was found innocent, the following has been said. There was only one purpose for going to the house. It was to kill this woman. The accused knew that. Alex knew that Trent was serious about killing this woman. What happened to the deceased strikes at the very heart of the things that we as a community hold dear to us. That we can all feel safe in our home, that we can all feel protected from the sort of brutality that Trent visited on this woman on this night. A careful consideration of the evidence and an application of common sense and logic can tell you in a very powerful way that there was a plan between these two boys to kill this woman. A review of the matter of the phone call, which focused on the handling of the incident by the emergency response operator, found that the handling of the call represented a serious lapse in judgment in providing an appropriate police response to Ms. Kampainen's circumstances. The report rules out staffing levels within the call centre as a factor in the way that this call was handled. In fact, there were no other calls waiting to be answered. A disciplinary inquiry will be conducted in relation to the way the call was handled.
A teenager with a senseless desire to kill will spend at least 15 years behind bars for the murder of an elderly Callington woman. And the judge has warned the youth not to expect release unless he can prove society's safe from any repeat of the brutal frenzy.
For Perio Campaignan's family, no words today. Devastated, she was the random victim of a teenager's murderous whim.
You're satisfied with the sentence today?
With a hefty discount for his early guilty plea, the now 15-year-old will spend the next 15 years behind bars for killing the former nurse. The quiet 63-year-old Finnish immigrant who lived alone was repeatedly stabbed, then bashed with a brick, her body found by her brother in the laundry of her Callington home. In sentencing, Justice Margaret Nyland found the murder was frenzied and relentless. The premeditated, senseless and savage nature of the crime places it at the very highest end of offending.
The judge said, most disturbingly, Ms. Campaignan was chosen completely at random. She was a stranger to the boy, and the only reason why he went to her home was because he was determined to kill someone.
Once you became fixated with the idea of killing your victim, it was the only idea you were able to contemplate. Psychiatrists found the murder was simply a callous and cold way for the boy to feel powerful. He suffers no psychiatric illness to explain his actions. The teenager was a mildly retarded social outcast, bullied at school, affected by domestic violence and graphic video games. He'll receive intensive treatment at a youth facility. Another boy is also charged over the murder. He's pleaded not guilty and will face trial soon.
If you haven't already done so, you can join us on Facebook, where there is an official Fallon True Crime page, but you can also find a discussion page called Friends of Fallon True Crime. For listeners that have asked about Fallon merchandise, I'll be updating the Threadless merch page with some new designs, so keep an eye out for links to that. And for those that have asked about a Fallon Patreon, I've stopped putting it off, and I've got some surprises in store for bonus content, so keep an eye out for that too. Thanks for listening, and if you have enjoyed Fallon so far, please do subscribe, rate and review.
Fallon, true crime, the underbelly of the land down under.